Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Didn't feel to me in the other books about Francis that didn't happen to me in the other books about Francis. He's in his larger than lifeness, he is somewhat otherized in the writing about him, accused of megalomania, madness, you know, indulgence, all of these things that I hope readers come to see in my book are grounded in a dream. And it's a dream that I think on some level we all have. Except unlike us, Francis is the only one with the means to approach it.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I am a writer and film critic, and today I'm delighted to start 2024 with a new book by Sam Wasson. We're going to be talking about A Path to Paradise, a Francis Ford Coppola story, or Coppola, I should say, actually. I mispronounced his name all the way through this podcast, so apologies for that. This is the third time he's been on Writers on Film. He was here with his book, The Big Goodbye, his book about Chinatown. He was also here last year with Hollywood and Oral History, a book he co-wrote with Janine Basinger, also a friend of the podcast and a former guest. If you enjoy the episode, please remember to like. You can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Jonty, DrJonty. You can also listen to sister podcast Cinema Italia if you so wish. That's available where all good podcasts are, and the fictional speculative novel podcast series Connery is also ongoing and available, again, wherever podcasts are listened to. Get it from any of your favorite platforms. I firmly encourage you. It's a really good, different thing that we're trying, narrated by Kai Ross. But before you do any of that, enjoy this fantastic conversation. I put on my Goodreads review that this reads like a novel that Francis Ford Coppola would option.
Oh, great. Oh, that's so good to hear. That's great. That's wonderful. Thank you, John. That's so, thanks for posting a review. That's so good.
It's a super book. And I thought and this was a book that I sort of thought, I know about this period. I know about Coppola. Right. I've seen the Eleanor Coppola documentary. I've read the notes of for the making of Apocalypse Now. And I've read, you know, the Peter Biskind book about the period, so I know all about it. And then you read this book, and I read this book, and I thought, there's so much more. It's so deeper. There's so many things you go into. What was your sort of beginning point for this book? What was the bit that you said, no, this story hasn't been told properly, or not properly, but hasn't been totally told?
Well, it was just that. It's that feeling that there's a hole in the library. And while Coppola has been written about for so many years, I mean, Coppola was famous, you know, as early as the late 60s, because he was the first of that generation to break out of film school. So Coppola had been widely interviewed, and obviously the success of Godfather, Apocalypse. He's been a visible public figure for half a century. And yet all of the biographical material on him was really centered around him as the director of The Godfather. And I thought that was wrong. The Godfather is a wonderful accident in a career with a totally different trajectory. A career that is A, about zoetrope, being a facilitator of films, an entrepreneur of films, and even a visionary of how we can live our lives. That's A. And B, his filmmaking career is, I thought, premised on a lust for spiritual discovery and community. So while Apocalypse has been widely written about, the sources you mentioned, it hadn't been written about, I don't think, to the fullest of its power, because it lacked these central attributes. So I thought I had a new perspective on Francis, and I think, you know, like everyone writing, I think I had the right perspective on Francis.
Exactly. Yes. And you used talking about the Apocalypse Now as a sort of as a springboard, a jumping off point. You use it in a way which feels very filmic, because it's like the book is a series of flashbacks and then flash forwards, and you play with time in a way that reminded me actually of Godfather Part Two. We're going back to see De Niro, you know, what he's doing, his rise to power.
Yeah. Well, I wanted it to be a journey up the river into Francis, the way the movie is a journey up the river into Willard. And also, I wanted you to feel the tension and the stakes that Francis was feeling. A lot of times in nonfiction, I find that it isn't as emotional as life. And I don't think that does that. I don't think that's honest to history. So a lot of that has to do with structure and style, how to bring that emotion to the reader. And that was one of the ways that I thought of to do it.
I think one of the things, one of the signs that it does that is it reminds me of like whenever you're a great work of art, whenever you're watching Hamlet, for instance, you want him to win the duel at the end and survive. You always have this glimmer of hope that surely he'll get out of this. Surely they were joking when they said tragedy at the poster. And I think when you read history, it feels like, oh, it's very clear that we're going towards something that we already know has happened. And you lose that sense that this isn't an event in the context. This is, the people who lived it as lived experience didn't know that this existed in a context which extended into the future.
They didn't know the ending.
Exactly. He didn't know what Apocalypse Now was going to do. He didn't know Godfather Part Two or Godfather was even going to come along. And you really capture that sort of lack of that immediacy.
Good. Good. Yeah, no, I wanted you to also, as I do with all my subjects, I want the reader to walk around in their shoes and identify with them. And it didn't feel to me in the other books about Francis didn't happen to me in the other books about Francis. He's in his larger than lifeness, he is somewhat otherized in the writing about him, accused of megalomania, madness, you know, indulgence, all of these things that I hope readers come to see in my book are grounded in a dream. And it's a dream that I think on some level we all have, except unlike us, Francis is the only one with the means to approach it. So I wanted to reverse that myth of Francis as a, I guess I said it as a megalomaniac or someone who was out of control. The part of Francis that is out of control, I think is very much conscious of being out of control. So that was one of the paradox that this is also about, and I hope to spin towards the positive.
And the community that you talked about just then, that was one of the parts of his process of creating a spiritual journey in a community. Mm-hmm. One thing that surprised me is when you go back to the beginning of his life and his family, which you do in some detail, partly because I think from hearing Francis himself speak in sort of documentaries and commentaries, you have this idea of him coming from this almost idyllic sort of Italian family background. Mm. And in reality, it's like, wow, that family has some problems. And, you know, it totally rejigged my idea of what the family meant for him.
Yeah, he's not so psychologically minded, Francis. So he doesn't view his family situation as, as neurotic as I do.
Right.
And other writers haven't positioned it that way. But I do believe there was neglect in the family. And also I found it in journals and personal writings in his archives. You know, you see sort of patterns of neglect if you can identify them as neglect. You know, part of what happens when you're children is that you justify the house that you live in growing up, and it becomes almost like a Stockholm syndrome to all of us. And you really need the point of view of a third person to come in and say, oh, you know, that doesn't sound so loving. And there's oftentimes resistance to that. But I'm confident that that's the environment that Francis grew up in. And I thought it was very important in terms of how formative it was for his life and work to make that clear.
Well, it makes the depictions of family and also his attempts to create a filmmaking family.
Exactly.
It shows it in a different light, surely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it's no longer recreating it. It's actually compensating for it.
That's exactly right. And again, it's not The Godfather. This is the mistake that a lot of people make, a lot of people writing about Francis. No, it's not The Godfather. He grew up under the influence of a powerful man, his father, but he was a narcissistic force in the house. And Godfather doesn't deal with that.
Yeah, I mean, the strap and the, you know, and even later in life, even when his father has been helped enormously by the work that Francis gives him as a composer, he's not particularly content with it.
Exactly. I was surprised by that. None of that had been printed before. I had not seen that in anything. But you know, these things, this is why there's so many biographies, because every biographer has a different view. My biography is informed by the questions I ask. I ask a lot of questions about those early years. Another biographer might not.
Right.
But that's part of my orientation. I believe that the person is made, like I said, I'm psychologically oriented. I believe that the person is made in those early years.
Yeah, the imprinting happens. And of course, he has like Scorsese, he has moments of childhood ill health
that's correct.
That sort of makes living through vicarious means very important.
Correct.
And he thought he wasn't going to walk at one point in his life.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. No, there was a lot against Francis. And it's often true of the most powerful artists that their power as artists is inversely proportionate to what they faced, the obstacles they faced as children.
And that can often perhaps, I don't know, I'm speculating, but also maybe somehow justify or rationalize the excesses that come later on, because they're sort of making up for lost time.
Yeah, no, there's a deficit. There is a deficit, an emotional deficit. And like all of us, it can be filled the wrong way. But most of us don't have the power, the money, the fame, all of the addictive temptations that people in the movie business have, nor are we covered in the press. So they're much more visible and have higher to fall and farther to go. But it doesn't make them any less human.
So Coppola starts his career coming from a sort of film school background, but very early going into actually making films and working with Roger Corman. I mean, initially he's making some sort of semi-porn films. Would that be?
Yeah, softcore.
Softcore porn. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember hearing somebody tell me, I'm not sure who it was, it might have been Paul Hirsch, saying that like a lot of those 70s directors basically started in porn because
how are you going to get in? You're going to get in the low budget world. What are the low budget worlds? You know, it's Roger Corman and porn.
Yeah. Who have got the cameras? Who have got the cameras and the lighting?
That's who has the cameras and the lighting. Exactly. Where are the industries? So, and again, it was softcore. It was not hardcore porn, you know. He did Tonight for Sure is the name of one of the movies that he made. It's true of all of us. A door opens and you walk through it.
Absolutely, yes. And then Roger Corman. He's definitely estimated. I wouldn't say he's underestimated or overestimated in terms of his influence, but he's very well known as being this wonderful conduit and magnifier of talent.
Who else was giving young filmmakers a job and saying, go ahead, you know, anything under $20,000 or however much it was, $200,000, have at it. It's a dream way to work. I don't know who else was doing that to the degree that Corman was. I don't think anyone.
I wonder why it's not replicated so much today. Is it there's just not the audience for that sort of film? There's not the distribution product? Because, I mean, Blumhouse, you know, other than Blumhouse, I don't see anybody doing that sort of keep it low and then have freedom.
Well, part of the problem is accessibility of film entertainment. Mm. You know, we can get low budget product is so ubiquitous. We can get that anywhere. We can get that online. We can get that on TV. In Roger's days, it was somewhat ubiquitous, but not nearly to the degree that it is now.
And when he made Dementia 13, which was his first film with Roger Corman, I think, as a director, right, in a way, that sort of creates a template for how he's going to work from then on in terms of he doesn't really have a film. He doesn't really have a script that's complete and ready to go.
Right on, John. I'm glad you got that. That's Francis is always in process, always in process. And that can make him hard to work with. It can make him wonderful to work with because he's always open to your idea. And that's part of the community environment of a Coppola movie, is that the process does not end. I mean, here we are today and Coppola is still cutting One from the Heart. You know, how many cuts of Apocalypse has he done? It does not end with Francis. So if you're the money, that's going to be a headache. But if you're the artist, it's going to be a playground.
The person who it reminds me of, and it's someone who you bring up in the book a few times and who just turns up in the book as a character, it reminds me of Orson Welles in his later years. But this is sort of almost like Orson Welles at the beginning of, you know, Francis Ford Coppola's almost like that from the very get-go.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying. I can see what you're saying. Yeah, that's a great comparison. I didn't really explore that so deeply. Of course, the difference is Francis is trying to create in Zoetrope a whole world, a whole community. He's not just thinking of himself as an artist the way that Orson is. I don't put any moral judgment on that. That's who Orson was. He was an artist exclusively. Francis was an artist, and he was also a visionary and a world builder, all of these things. And also he wanted to revolutionize Hollywood. Orson had to run away totally and never come back. But Francis was always doing this back and forth dance with Hollywood.
Yeah, I think with Orson Welles, you can look at him either as an unsuccessful Hollywood director or a very successful European director. It depends, you know, it depends where you want to sit. You know, if you base your focus entirely on Hollywood, then he wasn't very successful. If you base it on a more worldwide viewpoint, then The Trial is great, Othello is great.
Right. And you have to ask yourself, what is success? You know, is it box office? Then Orson Welles was not successful. Is it the making of art? Then Orson Welles was successful. So this is one of the things that is so exciting about Hollywood, is that there are all these different definitions of what makes someone a success. Do you have to be a success in your time? It's true of all art making, but Hollywood, the financial component is so important that it makes this an even more complicated question.
Yeah, I was just reading a book today that said Paul McCartney's Mull of Kintyre was the most successful thing a Beatle had ever done, including when they were in the Beatles.
Oh, my God.
But nobody would ever say Mull of Kintyre is better than any of the Beatles singles.
Right. There you go. There you go. Yeah. There you go.
So let's go through Coppola's career. As you know, we get Dementia 13, which is this sort of horror, this black, you know, it's basically cobbled together through one of Corman's, you know, typical ideas. We've got the money to make one movie, why not make two? And then you get Coppola sort of becoming much more, taking on a film which is much more himself, if you like. It's coming. Just go through those first few films before we get anywhere, and even a Hollywood film in the middle of that is in Finian's.
Yes. Well, he took, I mean, Dementia 13 is a job, it's his way in, and let's see, Finian's Rainbow is a big studio job, a musical, Fred Astaire musical. That's an unhappy experience. And so Francis decides, well, I can't live like this. I have to go make films my own way. And that was The Rain People. And that was where he started working in a serious way with George Lucas. And they went out on the road across the country with a work in progress script. I shouldn't say that. They're finished drafts, but Francis is open to amending these drafts along the way. And in the course of filming this movie, they decided, hey, wait a second, this is fun. What do we need a studio for? And that became the genesis for American Zoetrope.
And so from that point on, he's got this parallel career almost, but they're completely mixed, of him wanting to be a director, a producer, but also, you know, an independent studio.
That's right. And that's the story I wanted to tell. The dream of this this studio and how a studio isn't just a studio. It is a small city, and it is a plan for being together. Francis, I believe, you know, it gets back to what is success. Francis, I believe, achieved it. It doesn't exist anymore, but how long does something have to exist before we can call it a success? Is a second long enough? Does it have to, is it a year? You know, the fact is Francis got farther than anyone. And so I look at it as a triumph.
And to some extent, it has a renaissance later on with the films coming from Sofia Coppola as well.
Yeah, for sure. Those are zoetrope films. And Francis's upcoming movie Megalopolis, which I just read is going to be distributed soon. That's a zoetrope movie. It goes on. Zoetrope is something that changes its form. And so sometimes it's big and sometimes it's small, but it's always there.
And when it starts, when it's on its sort of first, what would you say, manifestation, I guess, it's really George Lucas who's producing THX-1138, and he's using the short film George Lucas has made as, and they've got all these scripts as well that are going around. So there's lots of activity going around, but there's this wonderful relationship between George Lucas and Coppola, which I think you get into the detail of, and you get into the nitty gritty of. It's a really interesting portrait in friendship, and also a sort of sense of rivalry and betrayal at times.
Well, I wouldn't characterize it as betrayal or rivalry, but they had two different visions of the future of film. You know, one of those is based in revolutionizing how we think of pre-production, and one of them is revolutionizing post-production. One emphasizes the script, which is Francis, and rehearsal, and Lucas emphasizes the special effects. We know which one has come to fruition. So in that sense, it's a sad story for me personally, but it's a great argument. Mm. It's a great argument. I think the emphasis on post-production, the pressure on post-production now is backward. Movies should be written either in pre-production, as much the movie should be written up front as is possible. Obviously, you're going to discover things along the way. And Francis teaches that. But the stories I hear, my friends in post, it's like they're rewriting the whole movie or using score to make up for emotion that isn't there. None of this was Lucas's intention, obviously. But the emphasis on special effects, which has nothing to do with storytelling, has taken us to a dark side, I think.
Yeah, it's almost like a bad musical where, you know, you just keep going to the song and but the song isn't good enough. You know, it's not advancing the story. It's not doing anything.
That's right. I mean, movies are about photographing emotion and cutting a scene to enhance emotion. These things are achievable without special effects. So I don't know what special effects contribute beside a sensation of momentary awe, but I can't say I've ever been moved by a special effect. I mean, maybe I have, few and far between. It's not to say that these guys aren't magicians. They are. And they've helped to make the movie wonderful. But if the work hasn't been done before they're called in, it's all icing and no cake.
There felt, when I was reading, Coppola, throughout this book, there are so many innovations, and there are so many things that today we take for granted, like pre-visualization, the idea of using cameras to live TV units to show actors their performances. But at the same time, I kept being nagged by this idea that it was almost like he was the wrong person to have these ideas, because pre-visualization for him just gave him another way of having five more decisions that he couldn't make, you know, or 10
well,
more
that's
decisions.
That's a compelling argument. That's a compelling argument and a very interesting idea. Yeah, Francis is a maximalist who has a million ideas a minute. And you could say that that works against him. It divides his focus. But you could also say that without that kind of maximalist brain, these ideas wouldn't come into fruition anyway. Mm. You could say that it takes a chaotic brain. But one wonders, like you're saying, what the world would look like if Francis's attention wasn't divided at that moment. One wonders what Hollywood would look
like. I almost wondered as I was reading the book, I was fighting with this idea that if he just said, you know what, screw the studio idea, it's taking up way too much of my energy, and I'm just gonna make my movies, I'm just gonna make films. I mean, A, would he have even been able to, would the studio have been able to, you know, would he have been able to work within the system? Or B, you know, would he have made many more films and you know, been, you know, would we have more Francis Ford Coppola films?
Yes, we would. If Francis hadn't gambled on the studio and lost, we would have, I think, better movies.
Right.
From Francis Ford Coppola. The middle part of his career in the 80s is really Francis trying to stay afloat. And he's a journeyman director. I think that Outsiders is good and Rumblefish is good. Very good, actually. But they're not distinguished movies. I don't think we could say that they could only be made by Francis Ford Coppola. But he needed jobs, you know? He needed jobs. What would the world have been like if Francis didn't need the job, if he had the freedom to make what he wanted to make? Well,
hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's hard to speculate because now that Francis does have the freedom and makes the films exactly the way he wants to make them, a lot of people don't like those movies either. and I'm one of them. So we don't know. Francis is an interesting case because he doesn't thrive, I don't think, with too much freedom. He also doesn't thrive with too much restriction. And, you know, if he had worked within a studio system, if he had worked happily within a studio system, who knows? Who knows? But it was either too much or not enough.
Looking at those amazing films from the 60s and 70s, looking at The Godfather, The Conversation, Godfather Part Two, I love the way you describe him. Almost The Conversation almost seems like he's just sort of tossed it off in the in his meantime, and yet is one, you know, is appearing on everybody's best films of the year list alongside Godfather Part Two, and then Apocalypse Now, as difficult as the production of that film is, it is one of the best films ever made in my view, and And looking at those, it feels so frustrating to watch to read about the behind the scenes and feel how much he was being sabotaged and how much people like Marlon Brando, he's demanding so much money. It's just like, Brando, man, you've got the money. Yeah. You don't need it. You know, give him a week for free,
Give him a week for free.
What else are you doing? What else do you need to do?
Actors have a tendency to see themselves as the center of everything. So I don't think Brando was any different. But that's my view of Brando. Francis was adamant that he had a great time working with Brando, and that this has all been overblown of Marlon causing him difficulty. I don't think Francis, having done the interviews and having gone through the records, I think Francis is remembering it slightly differently. But this is what makes. Book writing a challenge. I have the same view of Brando that you have. Definitely.
So The Godfather comes along, as you say, as a sort of very atypical. I mean, he's hired as a director. He doesn't want to do it. It's very reluctant in terms of, he's in terms of the material. He doesn't feel that he's doing something that is going to be like his personal film. And yet it becomes this huge success. Talk us through how that takes place, in your opinion.
Well, I mean, he put himself into it. And, The Godfather, the book is not what he filmed. And also he had Gordon Willis to give him restrictions that he needed. That was, I think, a secret weapon, definitely.
You describe Gordon Willis as recalcitrant, I think is the word you use.
Well, Gordon Willis, yes, of course. Famously so. The movie has been so analyzed and talked about. It's never any one thing. But what I've learned about the way Francis works makes me more inclined to position Gordon Willis as a saving force of The Godfather, someone who gave Francis real discipline. And I think the movie has a discipline that you don't see in Francis's other work. And that's from Gordon Willis. And I think that's what I would add, or what I would emphasize about the Godfather story, the Godfather success.
And then, of course, he has a conversation which you... It's really compelling, your argument that this is really an autobiographical film, that this is about the boy who thought he couldn't walk, the boy who felt he was ugly, who didn't feel loved, who couldn't have relationships except through a sort of voyeuristic, vicarious, film director style. And that just feels really that feels like a really interesting take on the film.
Right. I mean, when you, this goes back to why I wrote the book, when you place Godfather at the center of Francis, then you, and which is all about family, then you miss what the conversation is about. But in fact, the conversation, which was Francis's dream project long before the Godfather was never a dream project. So when you come to that fact, you have to look at Francis's emotional base not being family, but being loneliness. And family was the antidote to that. So there's a level deeper than family, is what I'm saying. And you get that in the conversation.
A couple of mentions early on, later on in the book, he mentions that, or maybe you comment on it, that he's not very good with women. You know, his women don't turn out very well. Mm-hmm. In Kay's mm-hmm. character is wonderful, but that's partly because of Diane Keaton much more than. I was thinking about it in terms of that whole roster of 1970s directors, Scorsese, Lucas, Arriva, uninterested in women, or they're Princess Leias, or they're Sybil Shepherds, or they're unapproachable. And even, you know, going forward to Apocalypse Now, Kurtz is running away from his wife, and you know, there's a
what a great point, yeah.
And also on that set, that making of, and I think this is something that is very brave about the book, and what I want to ask you a bit deeper about this as well, is you don't shy away from the fact that Coppola's marriage is going through tremendous strain during this, and Coppola himself is behaving in a way which has sort of previously been a little bit, let's say, passed over, or, you know, boys will be boys, or what do you expect? It was the 70s. And you actually go into the mistreatment of Eleanor Coppola, the infidelities, in a way that isn't sort of salubrious or exploitative, but at the same time is like, no, you know, these are human beings who are doing bad things to each other as well.
Yeah. I wouldn't say, I mean, Francis was unfaithful. It is relevant to my story because he's going to make a movie called One from the Heart, which is about a couple in a long relationship breaking apart and coming back together. And because Francis looks at himself, like I said, it's a spiritual adventure. Francis looks at himself when he makes a movie. It's, I think, essential to look at the marriage as you approach One from the Heart. And so that was a story that I was working on all the way through the book, and hopefully pays off in the end. But yeah, this generation is young boys. The figures that you mentioned, they don't deal with women. I would say that Bogdanovich does. I do think JC is, even though a girl, she's dimensional, and Peter grew up and made, you know, movies about with other women, real women. But, you know, Lucas didn't. Francis, I know some people go for Peggy Sue Got Married. I don't really. Scorsese, obviously, De Palma. And there's nothing wrong with not addressing women in your movie. There is no mandate that says movies have to be about women. They don't. That's not what drives art, is this what the society wants. That's called pandering. So I don't make any judgment around this. I only note as a historian that our spiritual godfathers, this generation, never seem to have grown up. And I have to believe, as someone who believes in Hollywood's power to make our lives better, that has had not a nurturing influence on the culture, especially when you contrast it with the way Hollywood used to be, which was all about love stories, and romance. These guys aren't. And that's okay for them. I don't know how okay it is for me, but it's their prerogative as artists.
Yeah. I mean, it speaks of something to the 70s, to that moment, to masculinity at a certain point. But as you say, any one filmmaker or any one film doesn't have to necessarily go around ticking boxes in order to be. And I think it's kind of fascinating for what it leaves out anyway. I mean, it is fascinating to see, you know, all these men who go to war in Vietnam. It is a largely masculine experience. It's difficult to think about. I mean, that's one of the deprivations.
Right. Now, there are also other filmmakers of the era who gave us terrific women. Polanski, Mazursky, Woody Allen. They're Cassavetes.
Yeah, I was going to say Cassavetes. That was on
the... Yeah, these filmmakers are there.
I'm thinking of Wonder, which was directed by...
Barbara Loden.
Exactly. A really standout example of a... I suppose Scorsese as well, with Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, is a really strong contender at the very beginning.
Yeah, Yeah, right. Yeah, you could say that. You could say that. Yeah. Yeah.
And Boxcar Bertha. I forgot Boxcar Bertha.
Well,
Oh,
you
sorry, right
know,
at
yeah. I
the
would skip over that one, but Alice, yeah.
beginning.
But it is a great question. Have we been influenced by boys? Have these men grown up, you know? And have we? Look at the movies that are out now. Look at the movies that are out now. You know, what is Oppenheimer, but a boy's movie? I think a lot of these movies are not for adults, and I implicate the women in that too. Barbie. So I think it really goes both ways. Who's the audience? It tends to be young people. We can sway young people more than we can adults, so they become the audience. It's a big question.
I'm not sure if it was Robert Altman or Paul Schrader who said, Robert Altman, of course, is also a great director of women, who said, did we have better film? Did we have better films back in the 70s? No, but we had better audiences. And it was that made the difference, that the better films got the bigger audiences. Nowadays, we have great films, but they don't necessarily translate into a mass audience. They're there if you want to find them, but they won't necessarily be the ones at the top of the box office.
Well, I take an even more cynical view. I think they did have better films. I think they did have better films. Yeah. Yeah.
Unnecessarily self-deprecating on the part of a 70s director, perhaps. So we get to One from the Heart, and One from the Heart, as you say, is this sort of big romance, and it's an opportunity for, it's almost like the apotheosis of the zoetrope experiment. He's got the studio, he's got everything, he's got all this power, and at that point it just starts to crumble underneath him with this, I mean, it feels like that's what the novelistic power of those last chapters, where you feel the ground underneath his feet. He needs 5 million to stay open for the week. He needs to, and then the sort of self-destructiveness almost of having those huge parties when he can't pay the wages. Man, that's not a good image,
Well, it what makes it a great story? What makes it a great story? No one ever thinks they're doing the wrong thing. When they're gambling, they gamble for a reason. So those parties were part of Francis's gamble. Borrowing the money is part of Francis's gamble. So it's my job to sit with him and say, okay, well, that doesn't look like a wise bet to me. I wouldn't make that bet. Why did Francis make that bet? And hopefully get the audience, the reader, to see why, from a certain level, those parties might not be as crazy as they appear. I certainly wouldn't throw those parties. You certainly wouldn't throw those parties, but we're not Francis Ford Coppola.
I just get the feeling at a certain point he just liked throwing parties. I don't think there was
Well,
that
he
much,
did. He did like throwing parties. He did. I mean, that's part of the community building that is so important to him.
So for this book, you've obviously done loads and loads of research in the archives. You've interviewed a lot of people, and you've sat down with Francis Ford Coppola over a period, I'm guessing, what sort of feel did he have for the book? I noticed in the acknowledgments you thanked our mutual friend Janine Basinger for the
Oh, well, of course.
for
Of
the
course.
introduction.
I don't write a book. We all write books alone, but there are always people looking over our shoulder. Always a couple of people, at least for me. And number one is Janine, for sure. She's the greatest historian of film there ever was.
I've got to get her back on the podcast, because the episode she did for me was like one of my most
Oh.
popular episodes and one of the funniest.
I always say if someone could get Janine on a podcast every episode, it would be the greatest film podcast ever. Yeah, so Francis and I, we had what I think of as a very healthy, intense working relationship. that was not always comfortable for me and not always comfortable for him, but if I could speak for him, but I think that that's part of what made it healthy. You sit there with a subject that you're writing about so intimately, and your subject is naked. And I, as the writer showing my work to Francis, am also naked in another way. And two people sitting naked across from each other are not going to be so comfortable with what the other person sees.
Wait a second, I've just got a visual picture.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And you have to be honest. And that's not easy for either side. Now, you also have to be kind if you're going to make your way through it. And we made it. And I know there are things in the book that Francis disagrees with. But to his great credit, he allowed it to be my book. And it was better for his collaboration because I changed my point of view on some things with his help. Some things I didn't, but some things I did.
What was the biggest disagreement you had?
A lot of it was about the family. I think Francis would have liked me to distribute more credit to his collaborators, which is a generous impulse. But I felt that I had done that sufficient to what was required to the story. You know, we have different goals as subject and author. He would have liked more details about certain things. I didn't feel they were necessary to the story. You know, these are all things that you have that there are judgment calls around. So no one thing in particular. Some things he told me that I had got wrong in my reporting, and he proved to me that I in fact had. So I was glad to change those. You know, history is imperfect. It's imperfect. And so is Francis's memory. So how do you emerge from this intact? You do your best. And I know Francis is on some level very proud of it because he bought 100 copies of the book, I was told, from my publisher. So,
oh, wow.
I do feel that it's a happy ending.
Oh, that's a real sort of, that's a stamp of approval, I think.
A stamp of approval. But what does it mean to a subject if they love the book? I mean, think about if it was you. Mm. Would you love a book that showed you warts and all? Would, you know, do you want that book? Francis does, incredibly, to his unbelievable credit. But I don't think it's anything that he's going to love. I think it's something that he's going to understand.
I think, just from my perspective, if you wrote a book about me like this, imagine that for a second. I would love the fact that somebody had taken the time to write something that was just so well conceived and well written. You know what I mean? I read a lot of film books, and anybody who comes on this podcast, they're always brilliant. I'm not gonna upset anybody, obviously, but there is sometimes they're brilliant because of the information you get. Sometimes they're brilliant because of I didn't know this, or this was an unexplored area of film, or this is a new perspective. They're not always brilliant because of the writing. You know, they're not always brilliant. The level of the writing sometimes is just not even relevant. It's just like, no, it conveys what it needs to convey. But the writing is so good, and the organization of the, you know, the story is so compellingly told.
Thank you, John.
That I honestly think you could read this and be the subject and just almost disassociate yourself. Yeah, exactly. As a book. You know?
Well, that's great praise. Thank you so much. I think it's easier said than done. I think But I really appreciate that, and it's important to me to tell a good story. Why else pick a subject? When you're writing biographically, when you're writing critically, it's not really your job to tell a story. It can be, but it's not necessarily your job. When you're telling biography, there has to be a reason you're telling it besides the work. It has to be because someone has lived a life.
Otherwise, it's just, and then he directed this film,
And
and then
then
he
he
directed the,
directed this.
yeah.
Right. And he directed this. And that doesn't pay homage to the drama of being alive. And I want to do that.
It's almost as though, going back to the question I asked earlier on, it's almost as though if he hadn't done the zoetrope and he had just gone, I'll just concentrate on my own directing, he would not have made as good a subject for you in this book, because
Well, that's right.
that's his Great Gatsby dream. That's
That's
his.
exactly right. I thought about this as the Great Gatsby. Yes. No, this is, and here is where I keep saying it, Francis has been misunderstood. It's not about Francis the director. It's about Francis, the leader of American Zoetrope.
And so, final sort of point then. His new film, Megalopolis, is going to come out 2024. Has a distributor, I think, in the US already. So, is that going to change the story? Is there going to be a new edition of the book in a couple of years, which will have an epilogue with, like, this has changed the whole view of how Francis is seen now?
It's very possible. It's very possible. We'll see. We will see. I haven't seen the movie, so I'm as excited as you are.
That was obviously intended as my other question was, have you seen any footage? What's it
Nothing.
like? Oh, nothing.
Nothing. I
Okay.
was there for a few days when he was shooting, and I wrote about it in the book, but I haven't seen anything.
Right. And I mean, I don't think anything has come out about it. There was a recent report, some bad press coming out, but that just sounded like the sort of usual scuttlebutt that you get on any big project that's been going on for a long time.
That's right. I mean, Francis, the press does not understand Francis or how he works, you know, and that's you when you write about Francis, you see that he's been on the bad side of the press from the very beginning because they don't understand the process, his process.
In a sense, there was this whole generation in the 70s and early 80s well, the early 80s decided to bring down the 70s, if you like. You make this wonderful comparison that you say, Heaven's Gate was this huge, massive, expensive movie. Actually, it cost the same as Moonraker, you know? And it's like, we all remember Michael Cimino, but who directed Moonraker again?
Right. Exact. John, perfect point. Perfect point. No, the public's view of Hollywood finance is so skewed by their own prejudice against Hollywood, their own envy, jealousy of Hollywood, and by the way the press writes about it. They don't know simple facts like this. So, part of my job is saying, hey, wait a second. That's not true. That's not true. That's rumor. That's gossip. That's hyperbole. Here's what this is really about.
I remember in our last conversation, no, maybe it was two conversations ago. This is our third conversation. So maybe we were talking about Blonde. And I'm not sure if you'd seen it up to that point. I was curious if you'd ever got to see it, because I think you hadn't seen it.
I haven't seen it. I've heard about it and what I heard and seen clips. And what I heard was offensive to me, and I didn't see it.
Right. Okay. Because I'm just interested as well that Hollywood does a very bad job of showing itself off to the world as well. That.
Well, Hollywood wants you to come see the movie. So if the way to get you to see the movie is to denigrate Hollywood, then they'll do it. If the way to get you to see the movie is to denigrate Communists, they'll do it. If the way to get you to see the movie is to denigrate men, they'll do it. Whatever it is, they're trying to appeal to the audience. It's a very expensive business in that way. So Hollywood lies about itself, against itself, to sell a movie.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know you're doing a lot of reading for research right now. And you've been reading, obviously, you've been researching a lot of stuff. But have you read anything in the last, calendar year that you've, last 12 months, I should say. So if I say calendar year, it's like 2 weeks. Have you read anything that you'd like to recommend for our listeners?
I wish I had a stack here to remind myself of what I read. New film books?
Mm-hmm. Or any film books, really.
Oh, any film books? Well, Janine's film books, Janine Basinger's film books, Richard Schickel's books. These are people who really understand Hollywood and write about it accurately and intelligently. A lot of people write about Hollywood. They haven't done the research. They take secondhand sources for granted. And they have an axe to grind. People like Janine and Richard Schickel give you the real thing. There are others, obviously, but those are two of my favorites. A wonderful book, a memoir by Irene Selznick called A Private View, about what it was like growing up as the daughter of Louis B. Mayer, the wife of David Selznick. That'll give you a view of what Hollywood really, really is. It's beautifully written too.
Mm. That's always a good thing. That's always a great sign, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, listen, Sam, that's absolutely brilliant to talk to you again. I love the book as I think I made clear. The long goodbye, not the long goodbye. The big goodbye.
The big goodbye, right, yeah.
The big goodbye we had you on for, then we had you on for Hollywood and Oral History, now we've had you on for Coppola, and it's just, I can't wait until you release your next book. Have you got anything you're working on that you could
Frank
talk about?
Frank Capra.
Oh, wow, there you go.
Yeah, Frank Capra, yep.
Oh,
yep.
My word. Okay, that's going to be a good
It'll
one.
It'll be years.
Right.
I really got to take my time with this one. There is a lot to cover.
Right, right.
Yeah.
A biography?
Some kind. It might be an unconventional biography like this one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's going to be soup to nuts like the Fosse biography was.
I was going to use exactly the same phrase. Is it going to be soup to nuts?
I don't think so. Yeah.
Brilliant. I'm really looking forward to it, Sam. And yeah, well, hopefully we'll have you on for that, if not before.
I would love it anytime. I'm so grateful for what you're doing.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Sam.
Thanks, John. It's always a pleasure.
Being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.